Are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant?
Yes, Your Honor.
And Major Delaney, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, may it please the court. I'm Captain David Bosner, and along with my co-counsel, Mr. Mark Bruger, we represent the appellant in this case, Airman First Class Isaiah Edwards. Chief Judge Olson, with your permission, I'd like to reserve 4 minutes in rebuttal.
Granted.
There are 3 points I'd like to discuss this morning. First, pre-recorded videos are not allowed under RCM 1001A because the President chose to not specifically permit them as a proper unsworn statement format. Two, trial counsel impermissibly participated in and in fact created Court Exhibit 4. This video also violates RCM 1001A's form and content requirements. And finally, the inclusion of this video prejudiced Airman First Class Edwards, such that setting aside the sentence is appropriate. To survive the plain language of RCM 1001A, a video must be an oral statement because it is clearly not written. And a video itself is not an oral statement. A video is a vessel or a container that can hold so much more than an oral statement. The video may contain an oral or written statement within it, but it can also hold music, photographs, lighting, sound effects, and all of this is subject to digital editing and manipulation.
Okay, Captain Bosner, let's strip away for a moment the idea of the music and the photographs. What about a Zoom call? You've got middle of the pandemic scenario. There is a right to be reasonably heard. Person can't travel. From your perspective, would a Zoom call be permissible or impermissible?
Your Honor, I think it would be permissible because our presentation to this court this morning specifies that an oral statement within the context of RCM 1001A and the entire MCM means contemporaneous oral communication. So in this hypothetical, if we were to strip away the use of extraneous props or other additions to the contemporaneous nature of the statement, if someone were on Zoom, Skype, FaceTime, or some other contemporaneous communication, that would be permissible and within the scope of the rule.
What is the magic about it being contemporaneous? If you've got a prepared written statement that was done sometime before, that's admissible. So why wouldn't a videotaped statement, and I'm setting aside the issue of any music or photos, why would that not be permissible?
Well, Your Honor, in RCM 1001A, the President makes a clear delineation between written and oral. And those two different forms of the statement have their different properties. But because this video must be an oral statement, we then look to what oral means elsewhere in the Manual for Courts Martial. And what we find is that when the term oral is used in the context of oral statement, it means a contemporaneous communication. When a video is permitted under...
Now, what specifically are you citing to in terms of elsewhere in the code where oral statement is referred to as being contemporaneous?
Your Honor, in our reply brief, I think specifically footnote 2, we list approximately 8 or 10 references in the RCMs that discuss what would be an oral contemporaneous statement. But also in common legal vernacular, oral statements are used to denote contemporaneous communications, such as what we're doing here this morning, oral argument, oral objections, oral motions, oral wills, oral contracts. All those are live, and it would not make sense in the context of those legal definitions to envision that this oral argument could be done by pre-recorded video. Now, when we look at more of what oral statement means within the context of the RCMs and the MCM at large, when a video is permitted, it's specifically permitted, which as a primary purpose here goes to show that when the President wants to include video as a format, he surely knows how to do it. Two examples are in RCM 914 and also in RCM 702 when we talk about depositions. So from that, we can conclude that the lack of specifically including video as a format indicates an intent not to include video as a format. And when we further drive down into what those two rules that I mentioned stand for, there's an obvious purpose behind why a video would be necessary in those circumstances, perhaps with RCM 702 depositions. That is in the context principally where a witness is going to be unavailable, and the deposition is taken for the purpose of securing the statement for presentation to the members. Under RCM 914, a video is permissible because in that context, a witness has testified on direct, and the opposing party, as a purpose of discovery, wants all previous statements before the cross-examination. And if that previous statement was oral, it would need to be video recorded to capture the essence of that previous out-of-court oral statement and provide it to the moving party. So those are two examples within the RCMs that demonstrate the president knows how to include videos. He did not do so in RCM 1001A. It also goes to show that when it's used purposefully. Within RCM 1001A, there's other indications in the rule that demonstrate contemporaneous communication.
Now, I understand your point about statement and how you feel that should be defined. But what do we do with this concept that a victim also has the right to be reasonably heard? Why wouldn't that open the door for a victim, setting aside the issue of the statement, if the method that facilitates their being reasonably heard is a videotaped or an audiotaped statement, that they can't do that?
Mr. Honor, so in RCM 1001A-B4, the president has defined what the right to be reasonably heard means. And the president carefully defined that as the right to present a sworn or unsworn statement. And in the unsworn statement description is where he then says oral or written. So when we talk about reasonableness or reasonableness of providing the oral statement, if the president had contemplated that as reasonable, he would have included it in the rule. It's not necessarily a judicial determination that it is a reasonable means of providing it, because under Article 36A, the president is charged with implementing the purpose of Article 6B UCMJ. And it's the president who decided you can have a sworn or unsworn statement, but if you're going to do either of these two options, here is what reasonable means.
I don't want to curtail the questioning on that point of my colleagues, but I'd be interested if you could please turn your attention to prejudice.
Sure, Chief Judge. There's the lingering question of what is the standard for prejudice in this case. Our position is it ought to be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt instead of the harmless error test on Article 59A UCMJ. Our purpose for articulating that standard is appropriate because this error is one of constitutional dimension in that it has the ability to affect the accused's right to a fundamentally fair pre-sentencing hearing. Let me give a few examples of how that may manifest itself. If a judge were to erroneously allow a non-victim to provide matters, if a judge were erroneously to allow non-victim impact matters to get to the sentencing authority, such as discussing uncharged misconduct or acquitted misconduct, if a military judge were to allow a specific sentence recommendation, or if a military judge were to allow the trial counsel to bootstrap aggravation evidence into an unsworn statement.
But specifically here, where do we find the fundamental unfairness in this case?
The fundamental unfairness in this is in connection to this court's recent opinion in United States versus Tyler. This video is not subject to the rules of evidence for the purposes of objection. So the objection is now constrained to RCM 1001A in both form and content. And MRE 403 has no bearing on the matter. So when a defense counsel only has the role for courts martial under which to object, and the military judge allows that extraneous information in, there's a very narrow box defense counsel sits inside of where it's hard to then rein in the information that's before the sentencing authority. And if we turn to the specific video in this case, there are many prejudicial aspects of it. Primary one of which is towards the end of the video, Mr. Hale, the father, in engaging in a question and answer session with the trial counsel. The trial counsel asked the father, "Are you still proud that your son entered the military?" And he pauses and reflects, and he says, yes, I am still proud. I only wish he could have done so longer. And then he holds his son's military uniform. And he brings that military uniform to his face and breathes in what's remaining of his son and has an emotional moment with that prop. Now, perhaps this didn't need to be material in the context of the sentencing case, but trial counsel then made this material. And he did so when he asked the military judge for permission and was granted permission to play back that clip at the end of his sentencing argument.
But where do we find in the record the fundamental unfairness? I understand your point about that particular vignette had the potential to be prejudicial, but can you point to anything where we would look at this as a court and say, we can see either A, how it was fundamentally unfair, or B, how it improperly influenced the sentence that was adjudged?
Your Honor, our response to that is it's how the video was used. It was used immediately preceding trial counsel pivoting towards requesting the members adjudge the maximum punishment in this case, which was life in confinement without the eligibility of parole. And as opposed to perhaps a written unsworn statement that a trial counsel could read into the record, this is the father of the deceased speaking to the members in sentencing argument, something that would surely be impermissible had the oral statement been as we traditionally understand it. The father would have never been able to resume his position in the well mid-argument or at the end of argument and re-deliver. But now, because of the video, that can happen. The father spoke again to the members right before trial counsel then argued for life. And then, when that video goes back to the members, we can reasonably assume the members reacquainted themselves with all the evidence and all other matters properly before it. At that point, we have...
But is it a telling point, however, that all that was in there, the trial counsel was advocating for that sentence. Here we had a case where the murder was particularly brutal and senseless, virtually no mitigation or extenuation. And the sentence that was adjudged was 35 years. Does that undermine your argument about how this influenced the case or resulted in fundamental unfairness here?
No, it doesn't, Your Honor, and here's why. It should not require the members adjudging the exact recommended sentence in order for this court to find that an error in sentencing substantially influenced the finding, because the strength of the government's case, the strength of the defense case are oftentimes two of the more analyzed factors under that standard. However, there's also materiality and quality. We submit to this court that the materiality and the quality of this case are so significant that it undermines the government's ability to sustain its burden to prove that the error was either harmless or harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Because as we talk about quality, we've already talked about materiality. But as to quality, the father of the deceased is now talking to the members in the deliberation room. This is of a magnitude and quality that is substantially different than had they heard from Mr. Hale a day earlier and went home and slept overnight, or whether they even reread his written court exhibit. That is an error of significant quality.
Counsel, when we look at prejudice, let's suppose we agree with you that this was the improper form to present this information, but suppose the father had taken the stand and said, I miss my son terribly. Every day I pick up his uniform just to smell what's left of my son, and I just can't get over this. And in other words, this information could have been conveyed in a proper manner, but it was conveyed in an improper manner. Do we look at the information, or do we look at just the improper manner that it was conveyed in determining prejudice?
Chief Judge, I see my time is running low.
Please take your time to answer Judge Max.
Thank you, Your Honor. Judge Max, I think it's both. One of the major issues we have in this case is the use of the props within the video. And we submit to this court that the father would not have been allowed to bring the uniform into court with him for a sworn or an unsworn statement. If in your hypothetical he had discussed that he does do this habitually, that his son's uniform does remind him of what he's lost, that would surely be permissible, as he is defined as a victim, and he's also, that would be victim impact. But the way that it happened should turn this court's prejudice analysis.
Further questions? Thank you. Counsel.
Your Honor, may I briefly move the time clock? Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, may it please the court. I'm Major Jessica Delaney, and along with Major Alex Coberly, I represent the government in today's hearing. This court should affirm the Air Force Court's holding that a victim has the right to be reasonably heard by presenting their oral statement through the medium of a video-recorded statement. Now, before getting...
Are you arguing that that fits within the rule, or are you saying that the rule is inconsistent with the statute?
No, Your Honor. I believe that RCM 1001A supports the ability of a victim to present an oral statement through the medium of a video recording. There's nothing in RCM 1001A that limits the...
Are pictures an oral statement?
So, Your Honor, that is a separate question. So there's...
Well, that's my question.
Yes,
are pictures an oral statement?
Under the plain language of the word oral, they are not.
Are pictures a written statement?
Under the definition in RCM 1003, they are not.
Okay. And is music an oral statement?
Not under a plain definition or the MCM definition, no, Your Honor.
And is music a written statement?
No, Your Honor.
So we have music and we have pictures that aren't an oral statement and they're not a written statement, but it's the government's position that presenting them is still consistent with the rule. I'd love to hear your explanation with that.
And, Your Honor, I think it's helpful. That is not the government's position. The government's position is that an oral statement may be pre-recorded. As Judge Olson addressed with my colleague over there,
that's a fascinating question, but it's not the case we have here.
There is an oral statement in this case that was presented through a video. There are also other components to that video, and it's important for this court also to recognize that there are different standards of review in this case that apply to this, to Court Exhibit 4. So at trial, appellant absolutely preserved the question of whether a video can constitute a statement. That was his direct objection. A video generally is not a statement. Now, of course, an oral statement can be captured on a video. It can be captured on audio. We know that from RCM 702. We know that from General Jenks Act and discovery procedures. And we know that even by hearsay statements, which can be presented via audio. Now,
let's set aside the standard review because I think we're confusing things here. Was it error for the military judge to admit this video? Admit is the wrong word, but you know what I mean.
Yes, Your Honor. It may have been error to admit the music and the photographs. However, the standard of review for the admission of the photographs and music, due to them not being oral or written, was not preserved at trial. So while it may have been error, it's the government's position that in this case it was not plain error.
Appellant objected to the video. How specific did the objection need to be?
Well, as this court has held in Hamilton, and even as we look at other things, they need to provide, you know, our Fourth Amendment jurisprudence, they need to provide the basis for the objection. Now, his objection at trial was that it was not victim impact, that the content was not permissible. Now, the content, the oral statement that the parents made, was permissible. The photographs could be evidence of victim impact. So the content was correct, and that's what he objected to. And even if this court looks at the Air Force holding, the Air Force Court of Appeals looked both at whether a video could be an oral statement irrespective of photographs or music, but just the basic question of can an oral statement be recorded and then presented. They addressed that issue, and then they addressed whether photographs can be statements. So again, even in that Air Force Court, we haven't had this focus on the language written or oral. And that's why we should apply the plain error standard to that particular question. And now,
do you prevail under the plain error standard? I mean, I think you just said that music is not a written or oral statement and pictures are not a written or oral statement. How do you prevail under the plain error standard?
So there's a number of reasons that the error, if there was one, would not have been plain or obvious. And the first is, of course, the fact that we need to read RCM 1001A within the context of the MCM as a whole and within the context of Article 6B. And that right to be reasonably heard. So a military judge certainly has to look at that, if the victim's statutory rights have been somehow impacted by RCM 1001A. We have the fact that RCM 1001AD, which talks about unsworn statements, uses permissive language. It doesn't use exclusive language. So there is a question of whether oral or written or oral or both, is that exclusive? Or is that inclusive language, and there's also additional ways in which a victim can provide an unsworn statement?
Let's discuss another issue of this. So to the extent, I kind of like Appellant's counsel's description of this as the video is a vessel, and it contains multiple things. It might contain oral statements from the victim. It also contains music. It also contains... there's a production. I think we've all seen in our lives videos that have no words in them but have music and pictures and make us cry, right? So they have some kind of statement. I would say it's an emotional statement, perhaps. So I would say this video has, in addition to oral statements, he's got these emotional statements. Whose statements are those? Are they the victim's statements, or are they the statements of the person who produced and put together the video?
Your Honor, there is nothing in the record in this case to say that the statements are anything other than the victim's. In fact,
during the motions hearing, they clarified on the record that trial counsel put together the video with the assistance and input of the victims. But it seems like it's quite clear, they made quite clear on the record that trial counsel produced the video.
Yes, Your Honor, produced, facilitated, assisted. There's any number of words we could use, but the...
So why aren't those the trial counsel statements? To the extent this video contains artistic expression, which I think that we must have been intended to influence the panel, why would we not say that those were the statements, the artistic expressions of trial counsel, which raises a whole other problem?
Your Honor, I agree that that could be a problem. The reason we don't have that in this case is because that actual argument was waived at trial. So
how was it waived?
Trial defense counsel stated, we are not alleging any impropriety on the part of trial counsel.
Well, now, I've read that statement many times, and I don't see anywhere in that exchange where the trial counsel rescinds any part of their objection. There is clearly this question, this is how I read it, you can tell me why I'm wrong. There is this question about exactly how the video came into existence. And I think trial counsel, maybe not intentionally, seems to suggest that, no, it's really the victims who did it. And then defense counsel comes in and says, wait a minute, I just want to clarify. My understanding was that trial counsel produced the video with the input of the victims. And then trial counsel says, yes, that's right. We all agree on that. So there's just this straightening out of the record of how the video came into existence. But I don't see any statement on defense counsel's saying like, oh, well, now that we've got this straightened out, we no longer have this objection. There is a statement, right, where they say we're not alleging any impropriety. But I think, I mean, I don't see how that says, that doesn't say to me at least, that, oh, the statement's fine. The video's fine. Whoever made the video's fine. I don't see them saying, that. I see them just saying, like, we're not saying trial counsel lied about who made it or there's, you know, any intentional misrepresentation about how it came into being. We're just clarifying for the record how this happened. Now, that's how I read that whole exchange. Tell me, how am I wrong?
Your Honor, I think we have to look at not just the statement that they're not in any way implying any impropriety was done, but that statement right there is not raising an objection. That's my point as to that. He's not saying at that point.
Well, they're there to talk about their objection, right?
They're talking about the objection that a video in general is not a statement, and it's actually the military judge who turns to trial counsel and says, I just want to understand this. Trial defense counsel does not raise this as an issue. The judge is questioning this with trial counsel, and defense counsel not only never raises an objection, but they say, we're not alleging impropriety, and then when the judge gives them
opportunity. But the whole purpose of this hearing was to talk about their objections. They have objected to the video.
Yes, Your Honor, and then the judge, after they've clarified, the military judge turns back to them, and he says, okay, so my understanding is this is a video that was done at the direction of the family, and trial counsel just helped them put it together. Is there a contest? And trial defense counsel says, we're not contesting that point. So we still
Well, he says, I can consider that, or something, I'm paraphrasing. But he says, now that we've straightened this fact, I can consider this when I make my ruling.
Yes,
so I think, in his mind at least, he hasn't ruled on anything. He thinks this is a live issue. This objection to the video is a live issue that he has to now, having had this little discussion, go and rule on, right?
Well, Your Honor, the judge also mentions that he recognizes that he needs to accept evidence in order to make a ruling. So at best for appellant, this issue is forfeited. There is never a point at which the victims or trial counsel is directly asked, is this the statement of anyone other than the victim? And that's the core question. Is it the victim's statement or is it the statement of somebody else? I agree with appellant on that point, that it needs to be the victim's statement. But trial defense counsel did not raise it, and when the military judge asked those questions, he still declined the opportunity to say, well, Your Honor, I do have a problem with that. Now we are raising this as an issue. That didn't happen, and given the extent of colloquy, it appears to be a waiver. Now, Your Honor, I want to address one other thing that you mentioned earlier about the video being perhaps a receptacle in which other things are placed. Another reason that this error would not be plain, Judge Maggs, is because there is a second unsworn statement in this case. And that, of course, is the appellant's unsworn statement, in which he has a written unsworn statement and also included photographs within it, despite the fact that, as we've mentioned.
And why does that go to plain error rather than prejudice?
Well, Your Honor, it goes to plain error just in showing that the language regarding written and oral unsworns is not clear. There is some level of ambiguity that has applied in practice, because the language for a accused unsworn is the same, in that it may be written or oral, and yet there's this inclusion of photographs. So it just helps to show that everyone at that trial was understanding that the language, written or oral statements, is not to be read in the most limited circumstance possible. And that's another reason why, even if this court were to find that it is error to include photographs or music, it should not find that it was plain within this particular case.
Counsel, how do you respond to appellant's argument or position that by allowing the video to go back into deliberations, you're now, if you're right, it's an oral statement, then now you have the victim in the deliberation room making his oral statement. How do you respond to that?
Well,
because
yeah,
this, as Judge Hardy points out, this isn't, quote, evidence, is it? In light of our precedents?
Well, so, Your Honor, it's not evidence. And in the same way, the accused unsworn went back to the members. Could they watch it? Yes. Exactly in the same way that they could look at the autopsy photos again, that they could look at the crime scene photos again. Anything that had been admitted as evidence, they could view. And then they could also view, in this case, the accused unsworn, which was not evidence, and this one.
Well, what would be your position if the accused introduced an unsworn video with music and photographs showing him being an All-American ball player, all kind of mitigating circumstances? And the judge says, oh, good, we'll send that back in the deliberations. What would be the trial counsel's response?
Well, Your Honor, we would certainly object. And this has been a long issue on unsworn statements going back to panel members. For instance, when accused includes sex offense registration And that goes back and is impermissible matters. So, to my perspective.
Yeah, but it doesn't go back in the form of the accused himself or herself going back there and testifying, does it?
Yes, Your Honor. And I do think that that is sort of an additional question that's raised on this appeal, which is not the permissibility of using a video as a medium, but whether or not unsworn statements, which are court exhibits and not party exhibits, whether those should go back at all. That's an entirely separate question, which was not raised on this appeal. So,
well, I was just thinking in terms of whether or not the error would be harmless, if it's error.
Well, so on harmless,
Counsel, before we get to harmless, oh, I'm sorry.
Okay.
I just, on this particular point, going back, the appellant makes a pretty technical point in their brief, which is that the DVD is not a statement. It's not oral or written. It may contain a statement, but it is not one. And it makes a difference because the DVD became the court exhibit that went back to the members, where if they had just made a statement in court or if they'd done it by Zoom, it wouldn't go back. And I guess the question is, does it? How do you answer their technical argument? And it seems kind of picky, but the fact that it has a consequence because it does go back, that the DVD is not a statement, may contain a statement. They played it in court, and maybe you could have a statement that's played in court, but that it goes back where it's clearly the DVD is not a statement.
Well, so, Your Honor, the question of whether the DVD goes back, and this sort of goes to, you know, cases as well in which physical evidence is introduced and then photos of that physical evidence go back. So we do have this practice that's relatively common of something going back to the members that may not be the particular piece of evidence. Now, again, whether that should have gone back or not is a different question. There's nothing in the RCM, to my knowledge, that requires court exhibits to go back to the members, or for that matter, for a accused unsworn statement, which is also not admitted pursuant to the rules of evidence. Though, of course, they also relax the rules. So that couldn't certainly be a separate holding that this court could make. But to state that because there's an ability for a DVD to go back that precludes a victim from presenting a video unsworn statement does not comply with the language of the rule.
Your answer, thank you for the answer. Your answer does raise another question. Could now an accused present a video, a pre-recorded video, as the accused unsworn statement? I know it's under 1001 and not 1001A, but would this then, are we just deciding this particular case or whatever we interpret the statement, wouldn't that automatically then say that the accused could present a video, maybe even a very long video?
Your Honor, I believe what it would say is that if the accused wishes to do a video unsworn statement, that would still be an oral statement that he can do recording. But if this court were to say photographs and music cannot be included in a victim unsworn statement, yes, I believe that same standard would apply to the accused unsworn statement. As this court mentioned in Tyler, where the language is identical, there's not really a reason to parse apart the meaning. And an accused is also limited to a written or oral unsworn statement.
I interrupted you before you got into prejudice. And in addressing prejudice, could you talk about the issue of how are we going to be convinced when there's a term of years that this didn't make a 34-year sentence or a 34-and-a-half-year sentence into a 35-year sentence? I mean, you know, we're not just questioning, you know, would he have gotten a particular kind of punitive discharge, but the question of, you know, how do we know that it wasn't 30, they would have given him 34, but they gave him 35? I mean, there's a lot of evidence against him. He's going to get a bad sentence, but didn't this maybe push it up a little bit?
No, Your Honor, and I think what's really important to recognize in this case is because it is an Article 59 harmless error standard, appellant has not raised a constitutional issue. He cited to the rules of evidence, but of course that's a regulatory issue, not a constitutional issue. And under that test, we look at the strength of the government's case, the strength of the defense's case, materiality, and the quality. And with my limited time, what I'd like to focus the court on is the materiality in this case. Because this is not a case in which the only time that the members heard from the victim's father and mother was through the unsworn statement. In fact, they both testified and provided really quite riveting testimony when his father spoke about going to his grave and talking to his son at a gravesite and talked about how he had to physically hold up the brother during the hearing and when his mother testified that she could barely breathe.
Why play it during the closing?
Well, Your Honor,
why play the video again at the apex of the closing? Why do that? Right? The answer is obvious. Right? We know what the answer was. The answer was to sway the panel. Right?
Your Honor, as we acknowledged in our brief, that is some measure of the materiality. But he mentioned the trial counsel spends 8 pages of the record pointing to purely the evidence and then has about 2 sentences on the unsworn and then does play the brief play of it, which does show some level of materiality. But the actual content is largely cumulative with the government's case, with the testimony that was presented and with photographs that had already been entered into evidence. And then we have the gravamen of the offense itself and very, very limited mitigation evidence. So in this case, as the Air Force Court stated, the materiality of this particular video was eclipsed by everything else. And then again, this court needs to look at which portion of the video in determining prejudice. Because appellant stated, and this is a definite affirmative waiver, Your Honor, that he did not object to the statements themselves. So those audio statements aren't at issue on this appeal at all. So we're really just looking at the photographs and the music when assessing prejudice. And those photographs, as defense himself noted, might have been cumulative, tending to make them less material. And the music, as both the trial judge found and the Air Force Court found, was not so emotional that it would have prejudiced the accused in some way.
And yet the way it was used would suggest at least that the trial counsel thought it was one of the most it had more impact than everything else, right? That's what they closed with.
That's correct, Your Honor. For these reasons, this court should affirm the Air Force Court's holding. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel.
Counsel, I have one question. What would the appellant's view be on if the court did what I would call split the baby? We would say, under certain circumstances, a video of someone's unsworn statement is admissible. But not a video that was produced and directed by a trial counsel or some other media specialist, because I could see this just evolving, particularly in the Air Force, for your media specialist, into some dynamite video that comes in, you know, both sides, as Judge Maggs points out, from the defense unsworn and as far as the victim's unsworn. But what would you think about the court split the baby on that?
Your Honor, our first and secondary arguments are not mutually exclusive. It's our position that videos are always impermissible, and if this court were to assume arguendo that a video could be played, Court Exhibit 4 certainly does not pass muster. And that is for a variety of reasons. To include photographs and music are not statements at all. They're not mitigation. They're not victim impact. It also included props. We talked about the military uniform. It also included a question and answer session with trial counsel. So as I talked about on opening argument this morning, the emotional moment with the military uniform was a direct response to trial counsel asking a question. This is not about whether defense counsel objected to the video properly enough. As Judge Hardy mentioned, the objection was lodged and the military judge entertained argument on the motion. The military judge understood what the objection was about, and in fact, he ruled on it.
So you're saying that you're disagreeing with the government's characterization that the only objection was on this, the generic question of can videos be admitted?
Exactly, Your Honor. We believe that the defense counsel objected to everything. The very first thing that trial defense counsel said is a video in general is not a statement. He also said on JA-58 that RCM 1001A is limited. He talked about all these things. And when you object under RCM 1001A, It also implicates the fact that it must be personal to the victim, which means trial counsel cannot participate this in. So this isn't really about what child defense counsel did or did not do. This is what trial counsel did. Trial counsel produced this statement and participated in. And in the government's brief, arguing that this was waived, there's never an alternative argument that says, in the event that trial counsel's production and participation is not waived, it's either not an error or it's not erroneous. Because it is error for trial counsel to make this. It is error for trial counsel to participate in it. And the participation and production is prejudicial. It's prejudicial because the trial counsel provoked emotion out of the deceased father in the video. It's prejudicial because it was played to the members as the reason for requesting a life sentence. It was prejudicial because the members, we can reasonably assume the members would have watched again. So it's not, as the government argues in their brief, that the prejudice question is solely about, are the pictures and music prejudicial? Is everything prejudicial? The medium, the individualized contents, and it's our position that it's all prejudicial such that this court cannot be confident that the government has met its burden to prove harmlessness or harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt. And in this murder case, it wasn't blood, it wasn't a knife, it was a dad's unsworn statement that trial counsel thought was the most pertinent thing to bring to the members' attention before requesting that they sentence him to life. Pending further questions from the court.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides. The court is adjourned until further order of the court.